Good afternoon. My name is Kendra Mead. I'm a PhD candidate and a laboratory manager in the lab of Dr. Bill Beavis. And I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me an opportunity to speak on my thesis research. And I hope you will excuse the rather lofty title. In fact, it sort of describes my thesis research, but in fact I'm going to speak on a subset of it that includes the selection of a nonlinear model to describe biomass accumulation in maize kernels. So I'm going to begin today with a little bit about the motivation behind studying kernel growth and how the integration of physiological models into plant breeding could improve our ability to predict genotype to phenotype. Then go on to the experimental approach used, the modeling and results, and the future steps that I'm and things I'm currently working on. So, of course, one of the primary difficulties in plant breeding today is our ability to accurately predict the relationship between genotype to phenotype. And, of course, plant physiology studies complex phenotypes in a wide variety of environments, but while the idea of integrating plant physiology into plant breeding is an old one, it's one that perhaps has not been taken full advantage of. So by using the available crop physiology models, we can pick out the phenotypes that are most important and then determine that genotype-to-phenotype relationship by starting, this is an example, starting using mapping. To give you an idea of how this could be done, this is the growth process for two different lines. As you can see, they both follow approximately the same S-shaped curve. However, they differ for a few important traits. So the first trait, the upper asymptote or final weight, is being controlled by locus A. The second trait is being controlled by locus B, and that's the time to the inflection or time to maximum growth. So theoretically, by mapping for the growth process, we could then eventually select for a line that has a higher maximum weight and a faster time to maximum growth and therefore a faster time to maturity. So to approach this problem, I began by measuring kernel biomass and moisture accumulation in kernels. And the experiment could sort of be thought of as being grouped into two subsets. One, a mapping population that was composed of double haploids test crossed to a common tester, and then a set of checks. And there were 10 checks that were included the two parents crossed to a common tester. So I'm going to use those check measurements to talk about how I've gone about selecting a nonlinear model. And those check measurements were actually what was used to select the nonlinear model. Now that I've selected a nonlinear model, I'm applying that nonlinear model to the mapping population and going on to determine QTL that are associated with kernel growth using the nonlinear model. The observations that I'm talking about today were taken in 2 years. I'm focusing on 2010, however, because for those of you from Iowa, I'm sure you remember that in 2009 we had a shortened growing season with an early frost. So unfortunately, the growth pattern is not complete. The trait I'm talking about today is biomass accumulation, and it's measured as a function of dry weight of 15 kernel samples. And all of those kernels were taken from rows 10 to 15 above the base of the ear to control for the maturity gradient that occurs across an ear of corn, because rows 10 to 15 are believed to silk approximately first. In a previous study, I noted that there was a significant amount of variability, even within a plot, for silk time for plants. Since I was taking a sample as an ear, I determined that it was important to take silk notes on a per plant basis to control for the zero time point on the x-axis. I then sampled approximately once per day, starting just after silking, so 2 to 3 days after silking, all the way through maturity and past maturity. So there's 60 to 65 measurements on a for each entry. The model selection is done through the regression of dry weights on time using a nonlinear model, and that accumulation of biomass follows an S-shaped curve. So when I went to look for models that had that could be tested, they had to meet three requirements in previous studies. One, they had to follow an S-shaped curve. Two, the parameters had to have easily interpreted biological meaning, and that's so that the QTL mapping is more easily interpreted. And then the model should, of course, have converged to meaningful values. And by that, I mean when the model was tested by the person who determined the nonlinear model, the data set that they used should have converged. So sometimes that doesn't happen within nonlinear models. So from those, I selected five different models to be tested. I then went on to apply them each in a statistical analysis that treated the entry as a fixed effect because this is, again, just the hybrid checks. So the y's in this case are the observations across time for each entry, with f being the function, the particular model of interest, and, of course, an error. Now, the errors in this case could not be assumed to be normal IID, and this is very common in a growth experiment where errors tend to be highly heteroscedastic. They increase with time. So in order to account for that heteroscedasticity of errors, the residuals were modeled as a function of time to a power of delta that was constant for all entries. I then used AIC and BIC scores to assess each model, and of course, with information criteria, a lower score is a better score. And just keep in mind that the Bayesian information criterion does tend to select for a model with a fewer number of variable parameters as compared to the Akaiki. So this is the results of that modeling exercise. Just to note, as you can see, there are two different parameterizations of the logistic and the Richards, and that's because the logistic and Richards, they can include a variable lower asymptote. Now, in this case, what I found was that the variable lower asymptote usually resulted in them estimating an initial kernel weight of a low negative number. So, for example, sometimes the initial kernel weight would be estimated as negative 40 milligrams per kernel, which, of course, doesn't make sense. So those were discarded from further consideration. The Chancer model failed to converge for this data set. Basically, the initial values, though I tried a large number of initial starting values, it failed to converge. Finally, the Gompertz and Weibull appear to be approximately comparable. However, the Gompertz model was selected overall due to its ability to converge over a wide range of starting values, which is important for a nonlinear model, which frequently will fail to converge within certain starting, unless the starting values are very stable. It also, the parameters tended to have greater biological meaning. So this is the result of the regression of the Gompertz of the dry weight onto the time from silking for each of the 10 hybrids. As you can see, the Gompertz has three different parameters. Tmax is the time to the maximum inflection point. So that's approximately right here. So time to inflection point or time to maximum growth. Asymptote suggests the upper asymptote, which as you can see is what's differentiating the models more from each other more than anything else. And relative growth rate here, which is the growth rate relative to the final kernel volume or to kernel volume overall. I found it really interesting that the growth rate relative to volume is approximately constant across these hybrids, suggesting that they're growing at about the same rate. The time to maximum growth does tend to vary between hybrids, though obviously not as greatly as the upper asymptote. So this is the result from the two parents of the double haploid population that I'll be mapping within. And as you can see, the primary differentiating factor for these two S-shaped curves is the upper asymptote, or the final kernel weight. So some conclusions. The final model does appear to rely most strongly on the upper asymptote, so it suggests that the final kernel weight is what's differentiating the growth of the hybrids overall. However, when time is adjusted for flowering, the time to maximum growth rate differs between hybrids. However, keep in mind that these hybrids were within the same CRM. And finally, the Gompertz function was selected to model kernel biomass accumulation in further mapping studies. So things I'm currently working on, I'm working at selecting a moisture accumulation model and applying those models to a mapping population. And I'm also working at incorporating this nonlinear model into a mapping methodology that includes the nonlinear model directly in the mapping methodology as opposed to mapping for the parameters as the phenotype. With that, I'd like to thank Drs. Knapp, Karakwery, and Miguez for their assistance with the analysis. Darren Schneider and Chris Meyer were both very valuable in carrying out the experiment, and Mark Newell and Franco Azora assisted with the presentation. Financial support was provided by Iowa State's Plant Sciences Institute and Pioneer. With that, I'd like to ask for any questions. The mapping methodology that I'm planning on using is closer to a composite interval approach. However, it's unusual in that the phenotype is actually the differences between the curves as opposed to the parameter value. So it's not as though I'm mapping directly for final kernel weight. I'm mapping for the shape of the curve. Yes? No, I did not.
Were there any differences also if you used a heteroscedastic error versus a just regular?
Yes. Yes, that did result in a significant difference. In fact, frequently the models would fail to converge altogether if the heteroscedasticity of the errors was not accounted for. I did look at a few different approaches to modeling the heteroscedastic errors. In this case, the power function was the best.